Thank you very much for the welcome. May I say how good it is to be among you, and how kind of you to lay on some weather that would make me feel so much at home. I'm not sure what I would have done with some sunshine. May I begin with a prayer for presence. In the gift of this new day, in the gift of the present moment, in the gift of time and eternity intertwined, let us be grateful. Let us be attentive. Let us be open to what has never happened before. In the gift of this new day, in the gift of the present moment, in the gift of time and eternity intertwined. Amen. Perhaps the most cherished image in the Celtic Christian world is the image or the memory of John the Evangelist, but in the Celtic world he is more often than not simply referred to as John of Love, or John the Beloved, or John the one whom Jesus especially loved. And the memory is of John leaning against Jesus at the Last Supper. And it was said of him in the Celtic world that he therefore heard the heartbeat of God. And he becomes a symbol of the practice of listening. Listening deep within ourselves, listening deep within one another, listening within the body of the earth for the beat of the sacred presence. Do we know that we are bearers of this unspeakably beautiful beat? And do we know that we can reverence that beat in one another and in everything that has being? And do we know that it is that combination, growing in an awareness that we are bearers of the sacred presence, and a faithful commitment to honor that presence in one another and in the earth, that this combination holds the key to transformation? Do we wish to be part of this great work, the work of healing, in our lives and communities, among us as nations, and the healing of the earth? Some of you, I know, will have read one of my earliest works called Listening for the Heartbeat of God, in which I explore these themes. The book was published many years ago when Ali and I, my wife and I, were living in that country to the south of Scotland, the name of which I've just forgotten at the moment. And when the book was published, we were down in Portsmouth, down on the south coast of England. And I invited an Irish leprechaun of a theologian, Donal O'Leary, to come and speak at the book launch. Some of you may have come across Donal. And one of the great things about Donal O'Leary is that he doesn't believe we should just speak about truth. We need to experience truth. So he felt we shouldn't just speak about listening for the heartbeat of God. We needed to experience the heartbeat of God. So we were a group of about 100 people standing in a big circle, and he suggested that we pair off in twos and that we take it in turn to place our ear next to the heart of the other to listen for the heartbeat. Now, this was a good idea, But we were in this big circle, and Ali was looking across the circle. My wife was looking across the circle, and on the far side of the circle, she saw two young Anglo-Catholic priests from the Diocese of Portsmouth. And standing beside them were two very big-bosomed women. And she thought, if they place their heads in there, they may never emerge again. So she said, stop, Donald, stop right there. And she persuaded him that we should move into the much more tame exercise of placing our hand over our own heart or over a pulse wherever we get the beat. So I suggest that we begin our morning not just by talking about listening for the heartbeat of God, but by doing some listening. So wherever you get a pulse reading, whether over your heart or at your wrist or your neck, let's be aware of the beat of the sacred presence. This one beat, with its glorious multiplicity of manifestations, each one of us a unique embodiment of sacred presence. I invite us to bring this awareness into our reflections this morning. And I invite us to listen both within the vastness of the universe and within the intimacy of our own heart. And to know that these are two ways of the same posture. That the presence that we can be aware of deep within us is the presence at the heart of one another and at the heart of everything that has being. And that the deeper we move in the mystery of our own being, the closer we come to the heart of one another and to the heart of everything that has been created. As new science now invites us to be aware, the microcosm and the macrocosm are one. That what is most essential in each one of us is related to the essence of one another and every atom in the universe, everything coming forth from the one. As John the Beloved says at the beginning of his prologue, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Everything is essentially an utterance, an expression of the One. Or as teachers later in the Celtic world say, offering a paraphrase to the prologue, in the beginning was the sound, and the sound was with God, and the sound was God. Everything is essentially a sounding forth of the presence. So we are being called to resound, to resound with what is deepest within us and all things. Let's bring this listening posture right into this point in time, this moment in time. Because we are living in the midst of an awareness of life's interrelatedness, the likes of which humanity has never known. We are increasingly, from every major discipline of thought, of study, being invited to know that what we do to a part, we do to the whole. And that we will not be well through paths of separateness, but through the path of relationship, of entering back into relationship with the true heart of one another and all things. The ancient word cosmos, which means a harmony of the parts, is being born again in radically new ways. Carl Jung, founder of analytical psychology and I believe one of the great prophets of the modern human soul, spoke of us needing to recover what he called moon-like consciousness. Moon-like consciousness, which he distinguished from sun-like consciousness. Think of what it's like walking under the fullness of the moon. I know when I walk under the moon's soft, feminine radiance of light, I'm almost speechless. Because what the moon's light is inviting me to remember is the oneness of everything that I'm in the midst of. The hard edges of day are softened, and I see again the oneness that I am part of. Whereas when I walk under the sun's light, and we do occasionally experience that in Scotland, when I walk under the sun's light, I am much more inclined to speak analytically, because what I'm doing is seeing the differentiation of the parts. Jung's point is that we need both of these ways of seeing, but that in so much of our Western culture and Western religious inheritance, we have been dominated by sun-like consciousness. This is one of the gifts of our Western culture and education, philosophy, religion, that we don't forget the uniqueness of the part. But we have lived in a tragic forgetfulness of the oneness from whom we have come and of whom we are part. So we're being invited into a bringing together again, sun-like consciousness, moon-like consciousness. Now, in many ways, new science has led the way. And by new science, I'm referring to the way in which science, many sciences and scientists are inspired in most of their work by this growing awareness of the interrelatedness of all things. So in many ways, new scientists have been the prophets of this new consciousness. Think of someone like David Bohm, B-O-H-M, the new physicist who, before he died, wrote that most seminal work called Wholeness and the Implicate Order, in which he enables us, as so many new physicists have, to see that everything that has emerged in the universe, everything, was implicated in that first moment, in that tiny pinprick of light from which the universe has unfolded and is unfolding. Everything is an explication or a becoming explicit of what was implicated or implicit in that first moment. John Scotus Eriugena, 9th century Irish teacher, says something very similar. He says, "We and all created things were created at the same moment." He doesn't mean that we and all things became visible at the moment, same moment. He says, "We and all things have been hidden in the secret folds of nature, waiting for the time of our manifestation." We have been hidden in matter, in the matter of the universe. And of course, matter comes from mater, mother. We have been hidden in the mother. We've been hidden in the womb of the universe. Now is the time of our manifestation. We have emerged. How shall we use this time of our manifestation for the healing of the whole? So in many ways, new science is only catching up with some of the ancient wisdoms of our great spiritual traditions, which in their gloriously varied ways have been saying the same thing. And that is that we come from the One, and we will be well to the extent that we reconnect with the One. As the Quran says, we came from God as one. and to God we shall return as one. The extraordinary thing is that we've thought there's some other way to do it. The extraordinary thing is that we have pretended that we could be well through paths of separateness. We have pretended as a nation that we could be strong and well by only looking after the interest of our nation at the expense of the well-being of other nations and other people. We have pretended as a human species that we could be well by looking after humanity alone at the expense of Earth's other species. We have pretended as a religious tradition that we could be complete without the wisdom of Earth's other religious traditions. We need one another as much as the species of the Earth need one another to be whole. Our great religious traditions have been given not to compete with each other, but to complete each other. Now, if this is the deep spirit of the age in which we are living, this increasing consciousness of Earth's oneness and the interwovenness of everything that exists, if this is the deep spirit of this moment in time, then what are we to make of the fragmentations that we are part of, some of which are more dangerous than anything humanity has seen? Where do these energies of fragmentation come from? I believe that the most dangerous forces of fragmentation in our lives and in our world issue forth from fundamentalism. By fundamentalism, I'm not just meaning religious fundamentalism, I'm certainly including that, but I'm referring also to national fundamentalisms, to species fundamentalism, to sexual orientation fundamentalism, to any system that defines truth in hard-edged terms and wants to say that what the rest of humanity needs to do is to come inside our box of definition, that what every other nation in the world needs is our form of democracy. Of course. That what every other people need is our religious truth, our sacraments, our belief system. And the list goes on and on. And by fundamentalism, I am truly not just pointing out there. I'm inviting us to name and confront the fundamentalist within us, within our household, within our nation, within ourselves. When does the fundamentalist within us rear its head? It's primarily at times of enormous change. Think of some of the most extreme forms of fundamentalism that our Christian household has ever experienced in the 19th century, with the rise of papal infallibility, or with the rise of biblical literalism. Both of these fundamentalisms within our Christian household reared their head at a time of enormous change. It was in the wake of evolutionary thought, when humanity was waking up to the realization that life does not exist in fixed categories. Life is forever unfolding. It's forever evolving. The universe is forever looking for its new form, new expression of life. It was also in the wake of higher literary criticism, when it seemed that some of our sacred texts were under assault. So the fundamentalist within us, within our household, reacted at that time of change and tried to impose the definitions of the past on the emerging future, in hard-edged, inflexible terms. We also are in the midst of enormous change, and it could be argued that we are living through the biggest change that humanity has ever known, because we are being invited into a radically new way of seeing. We are being invited to see that everything is interrelated, so that no longer can we pretend that it is adequate just to look after our own nation, or adequate just to look after our own family or our own species, or that we can be complete just with our own religious household's inheritance, that we need one another. So the fundamentalist within us, within our nation, within our religious household, at some level, is realizing that if this is true, that we are interrelated, that we cannot be well in through paths of isolation and separation, but by moving back into relationship. The fundamentalist within us is again frightened, realizing that if this is true, we are being invited to change radically. So I believe we live at a costly moment in time. The question is, what sort of cost is it going to be? Is it going to be the cost of further and further fragmentation, in which we destroy the life of this planet as we have known it? Or is it going to be the cost of transformation? And a time of costliness in which we in the Christian household are being invited to come radically back into relationship with the teachings of our beloved Jesus, who teaches the way of sacrifice as the way of love. And that we will live only to the extent that we learn in radically new ways how to die. To die to our ego. To die to the ego of our nation, or the ego of our religious tradition, or the ego of our species, which is pretending that we can be well by looking after ourselves, rather than by moving into the holy sacrifice of love, in which we know that we will be well to the extent that we care for the heart of one another, and care for the heart of other nations, of other species, of other religious traditions. So I invite us into this listening posture, and to listen in the context of this growing consciousness and awareness, and to ask how we within the Christian household can be part of serving this new consciousness. How we can be part of leading it, instead of either totally irrelevant to it or opposed to it, to the extent that we continue to give the impression that wholeness or salvation is something that can be pursued separately and for oneself, instead of in relationship with the earth and with everything that has come forth from the holy womb of the universe. I invite us also to be aware of what is happening at this point in time to our Christian household. Because in many parts of the Western world, we are in a state of collapse. And certainly in Britain, in the Church of Scotland, the Church of England, Christianity in the British context, this collapse can only be described as seismic collapse. In another 25 years, it will simply not be as it has been, such as the rate of collapse. The question that someone like Bede Griffiths, the great Benedictine, who spent most of his life in India, offers us, is how do we access the seeds within the rotten apple? What are the new beginnings that we are being invited to be part of? Carl Jung, whom I've described as a prophetic presence, even as a boy, he had prophetic intuitions, some of which he didn't know how to articulate or was frightened to articulate as a boy. And many of his insights from childhood, he doesn't express until much later in his life. But as a boy, in 1887, walking home from school one day in Basel, Switzerland, he walked past the Cathedral of Basel with its shining new spire. And he became aware of an image that was surfacing from his unconscious that he was so horrified by that he tried pushing it back down. But it insisted on coming forth. Years later, when he chose to articulate it, he described that what he saw at that moment, above the great spire of the Basel Cathedral, he saw the throne of God. And descending from the throne, he saw a great turd, which smashed into the spire of the cathedral, and its walls crumbled. We are in the midst of the great turd falling. And it's not just falling, it's hit. And the walls of Christianity, as we have known them, are collapsing. So what are we being invited to do? And there are two very extremely different reactions or responses. One is a paralysis, in which we frantically try to shore up the walls again. A frightened response. The other, which I believe is a deeply faithful response that we are being invited to be part of, is to ask, what is the new thing that is trying to be born? And that will be born, in a sense, only out of the fertility of the great turd. Or as a woman very observantly shared with me after hearing this image, the other year she came up and said, you know, I'm very interested in this image that Carl Jung uses. She said, I'm a midwife. And in my 25 years of midwifery, I've noticed the turd nearly always comes before the birth. What her observation is inviting us into is this letting go that must be part of a birthing. So we are being invited into a rebirthing of God within our lives, within our nation, within the earth. We are living at the end of an era. You know, I so love our medieval cathedrals, and I believe in the rebirthing. These great cathedrals and so much of their inheritance and culture and music may well serve the new birthing. But as long as we allow our spires and all of the religious imagery and language associated with them to give the impression that the sacred is primarily beyond us or limitedly transcendent and not also deep within, immanent, then our spires are going to collapse. The reality about most of our medieval cathedrals is that they were built on holy wells. And what we are being invited to do is to know that our well-being is something that is to be accessed by the deep sacred presence at the very heart of our being and at the heart of the earth. Paul Tillich, prophetic Christian teacher, German-American theologian, as early as the 1940s, he was speaking of God as the ground of being, pointing to what we so desperately need to access and to experience now. Over the last 5 years in my life, it has been so interesting for me as a father to observe the dancing of my second daughter, Kristen. She was reared in the West. She was up on tiptoes, leaving the earth as a little ballerina from the age of being knee-high. She was into the ecstasy of leaving the earth. And now, and for the last 5 years, she has been in India studying the ancient sacred dance of India, Bharatanatyam, where she is nearly always flat-footed and bent-kneed and pounding the earth to release the sacred energy that is deep within. Now, in Kirsten's case, it was her body that intuitively led her to find the other half of her soul in India and to move back into that balance between transcendence and immanence. What are the intuitions that we are being invited into to move back into a balance between an awareness of the otherness of God and the deep withinness of the sacred presence? Mary Oliver, the Pulitzer Prize winning American poet, in one of her poems writes, "O God, love for the earth and love for you are having such a long conversation in my heart. Love for the earth, love for you are having such a long conversation in my heart." It is this long conversation that we are being invited into, that we long for. Carl Jung says, the spirit is a conjunctio oppositorum, that is, a conjoining of what has been considered opposite. Heaven and earth, spirit and matter, the divine and the human, the east and the west, the feminine and the masculine, the head and the heart, the conscious and the unconscious, spirituality and sexuality, the well-being of one nation, the well-being of another, all these so-called opposites that our religious tradition has so often sanctioned or blessed. Wholeness is to be found by a bringing back into relationship again what has been so tragically torn apart. Carl Jung says the devil is a dualist. He is forever trying to make two of one. He is forever trying to tear apart what God has joined together, the oneness of the universe. Do we wish to be part of this great work of healing, bringing back into relationship the parts that have been torn? Where do we look for the deep strength, the deep energy for this holy work? Julian of Norwich in the 14th century says most simply, but most radically, she says, we're not just made by God, we are made of God. We are not just made by God, we are made of God, she says. We're not simply fashioned from afar by a distant creator. We are born from the very heart or essence or womb of God, which is why Julian so loves to refer to God as mother as well as father, because she sees us as coming out of the very womb or out of the very essence of the One. What does it mean to say as Julian does, that we are made of God. In part, it is to say that deep within us is the wisdom of God. Deeper than the ignorance that we have done and been part of. It is to say that the creativity of the One is deep within us, deeper than any barrenness in our lives or world. It is to say that the creativity that is at the heart of the universe, something of the essence of that creativity is deep within us. And above all else, it is to say, as Julian does, that the deeper we move in the mystery of our being, the closer we come to what she calls the love longings of God. We and all things have been created by the One. We have come forth from the One. Deep within us are the love longings, the yearnings for oneness of God. These holy yearnings are at the core of our being. Although we may tragically spend a whole lifetime not knowing how to satisfy those yearnings. Grace is given to enable us to access again the holiest yearnings of our being. The reality is that we live in a type of forgetfulness, or as John Scotus Eriugena in the Celtic world says in the 9th century, we suffer from a bondage to forgetfulness. Soul forgetfulness, he calls it. In the Celtic world, Christ is often referred to as our memory. We have forgotten who we are. Christ comes as our memory, or he's also referred to as our revelation. This word that comes from the Latin root revelare, which just means to lift the veil. Christ lifts the veil, not to show us a foreign truth, but to show us the deepest truth, the most intimate of truths, to show us that we are made of God. Every day in the Christian household, every week, the confessional statement is used to refer to Jesus as the only begotten Son of God. And it's been used to give us the impression that Jesus is of God in a way that is entirely foreign to how we and all things are of God. It's Meister Eckhart in the 14th century who clarifies what that phrase means. Only begotten, he says, means begotten of the only One. Jesus is our memory. He shows us that we are begotten of the only One. The universe is begotten of the only One. Each one of us only begotten. Each one of us made of God. In and by ourselves, we are nothing. We are nothing. We are nothing. And yet within us is everything. Within us is the One who is everything. We are being invited to follow the wisdom of our beloved Jesus, who teaches us that we will live only to the extent that we die. Shall we do this work of dying to our separating ego, of refusing any longer to believe that we can be well truly by looking after ourselves in isolation from one another, or that our nation can be well by looking after our ego of nationhood at the expense of other nations, or that our species can be well by serving only the ego of the human species at the expense of Earth's other species. Shall we do this work and be part of a rebirthing, the rebirthing of God within us, among us, for the Earth? I invite us at this point in the morning, before our mid-morning break, to move into meditative posture for about 5 minutes, and to allow some of the themes of the morning to move from the head down into the heart, or to move into a type of equipoise between head and heart. And I invite us to do this through a very simple use of chant, through a repeating of words in chant form. And the recorded chant that we'll be using is from the CD Chanting for Peace, which I created with some Scottish musicians, in which we use words from the Quran, words from the Hebrew Scriptures, and words from our beloved Jesus to pray for peace. This particular chant that we'll be using comes from the Quran, and the words are, "Whichever way you turn, there is the face of God. Whichever way you turn, there is the face of God." And you'll hear an Arabic descant running through the chant. What you'll hear are the words Ya Basir, which just means God the all-seeing, or God the face everywhere. I invite you, as soon as you become familiar with this chant, to join it. They're very simple. The words are, whichever way you turn, there is the face of God. And after we sing it together for about 5 minutes, let's just allow ourselves a minute of silence after the chant to savor the silence, and to hear these words continuing to resonate within us. Then we'll have a mid-morning break, and after the break there will be opportunity to move into some dialogue around these themes.
Amen.
Some of you may have noticed that was not whichever way you turn there is the face of God. But we'll see if we have time later in the morning.
Thank you so much, John Philip. Thank you. Let's break.